Yale Podcast Network.
Welcome to ISM Fellows in Conversation, a podcast from the Yale Institute of Sacred Music. The episodes in this series present a discussion between a current ISM student and a visiting researcher in the ISM Fellows Program. Each year, the Institute hosts a cohort of fellows who are in residence for 1 year to pursue interdisciplinary projects and teach at Yale. The following conversation focuses on the diverse research, teaching, and creative work of a current ISM fellow.
My name is Cindy Yang. I'm an MAR student at Yale Divinity School and the Institute of Sacred Music, concentrating in religion and the arts. I'm here with Dr. Corey Hunter, who received his PhD in musicology from Princeton University. He's currently assistant professor of music at the Eastman School of Music. Dr. Hunter, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start asking how you got interested in your field of study in the first place.
Yeah, I would say musicology in general was the absolute last field that I ever expected I would get into. It was the boring 8 a.m. class in undergrad that nobody wanted to go to. And so, especially I was not only I'm a professor there at Eastman now, but I was an undergraduate student there. And got my Bachelor of Music there in vocal performance, right? So we just wanted to perform and do like all the performance classes. So music history class was like the boring kind of academic class that nobody wanted to do. It really was coming here at Yale doing my MDiv here where I really began to, have a passion for the scholarship of music, not just the performance of music. And I saw that there was more than one way that I could contribute to just the enterprise of music in general. And it was going to the weekly colloquium sessions every week, seeing these different scholars come in and talk about music from a very intellectual standpoint. And I said, maybe a PhD is for me, or it was just something very inspiring about being at Yale, hearing top-notch scholars talk about music in a way that I had not been really introduced to. And so I discovered, of course, there weren't that many writings on gospel music. And so I said, well, this would be ideal because I saw that there was sort of a gap in the literature that I felt like I could fill. There was just so much missing. So for a while, actually, when I was here at Yale, to be honest, because I also have a passion for scripture, biblical literature, I was considering going to do my PhD in Old Testament literature or New Testament, right? And then I think they told me all those languages you had to learn that kind of scared me away. But it was after systematic theology with Miroslav Volf, I was just randomly talking about, I'm thinking about doing my PhD. I think this was either my first year or my second year. And it was an older lady, and she came out because everybody knew I could sing because I was singing a lot in chapel. And she said, have you ever thought about music, a PhD in music? And I was like, no, I hadn't thought about a PhD in music. So that was sort of like a spark combined with, going to the different colloquium sessions and sort of being really cultivated as an intellectual in this environment that led me to go into musicology.
Yeah, I also share your background. So I went to Manhattan School of Music as a piano performance for my undergrad, and the courses in musicology that I took then were also seemed to fit in a very conventional, perhaps like 19th century, almost a little bit outdated sort of modes of understanding and analyzing music in a very particular way, according to a very particular convention.
Exactly.
And I also found it rather limiting, not to say that it's not valuable, but there's something about it that I felt was missing for me personally. And so I share your desire to look into other spaces, especially, here at Yale Divinity. I find that there's a strong sense of support for the performing arts, which is very valuable, especially at the ISM.
Right.
But also the other component, as you mentioned, is the strong intellectual aspect of it and really engaging with music in a very different mode. It's still just as serious, although it's rather unexpected for me as someone who had just come from a purely music performance background as an undergrad. And so this has also been quite liberating and really engaging for me. So I'm happy to hear someone like you talk about looking at different academic and intellectual trajectories while still having music as the locus from which you operate everything else.
Exactly. And I would say coming to Yale, the reason why, because I got into many different divinity schools, top-notch divinity schools and seminaries, and I chose to come to Yale because of like the ISM. So it's like this conglomerate where you could bring together like ministry, music, performance. So I felt like by going into the ministry, I didn't have to abandon sort of my musical performance aspirations as well. And so I really felt like doing a PhD in musicology, specifically in gospel music, could kind of help me continue to engage performance and singing as well as doing the scholarship, because just gospel music in general brings together nicely performance, religion, biblical literature, theology, so I still kind of get that fix in there as well, and like music scholarship. So kind of for me, doing gospel music research brings it all together.
So you had mentioned that you were at Yale as an MDiv student, and so now you're back as an ISM fellow, and I'm curious, what specifically are you working on as an ISM fellow that's relevant to the ISM project and what the institution aims for?
Yeah. So the name of my book is Spiritual Realness in Black Gospel Music Discourse and Practice. So as a part of this book, I use spiritual realness as a kind of theoretical framework for understanding how gospel artists articulate candor, transparency, vulnerability, interiority through musical practice and discourse. So each chapter is kind of a case study to understand how gospel artists use performance, use music, use discourse to articulate the real. Okay, and I'm talking about it in the context mainly of the 21st century, this sort of shift culturally toward keeping it real, right? The emergence of the reality show, like in the 1990s, it really took off in the late 90s, right? So I'm arguing that a part of the popular cultural infatuation with the real, how gospel artists begin to accommodate that in order to keep the church relevant, in order to keep the gospel industry relevant, because gospel music, ever since its, you know, origins in the 1930s, it was always sort of accommodating new sort of popular cultural trends, like it accommodated the blues, and it has accommodated hip-hop, right? So I look at this as another iteration of the ways in which gospel artists are accommodating popular cultural trends, particularly in light of all of these statistics being released about the church declining in popularity, folks are leaving the church. What can we do to keep the church relevant? Well, we have to be real, because millennials and Gen Zs, they're tired of the fakery, they're tired of the phonery, they're tired of, you know, all of the facades. You know, we have to pull back the layers of the facades and the performance and just be real, right? So it incorporates popular cultural perceptions of the church and the ways in which gospel artists are attempting to push back against those popular cultural stereotypes of the church. And in many ways, they're engaging in a kind of evangelistic strategy, right, to attract people outside of the church who have been put off or turned off by the church's dogmas and traditions, as well as maintaining people within the church who are sort of fed up with the church's dogmas as well, right? So it engages in terms of its relation to the ISM, right? Because the ISM brings together theology, religion, you know, ministry, music. So my work, I'm engaging in musical analysis as well to see what's happening musically. How are the various musical, melodic, harmonic constructs serving this sort of construction of the real within the confines of the church and what they're doing to maintain relevancy? So it's musical, it's theological, it's performative, it's all that good stuff.
I'm really struck by the way you're hinting at something that I think is really interesting that I'd like to tease out a little bit more, and that is the different kind of methodologies that you engage in as a scholar, right? So you say that you have a PhD in musicology, and I suppose to anybody who ordinarily listens to that might think, oh, well, it's confined within the conventions of what music has traditionally been throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, for example. But you seem to be doing something fresh, right? You're bringing theological implications as well. And I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more in detail about these different kinds of methodologies, what you're doing to make musicology fresh so that it's not just confined to score studying and musical analysis, right? But also bringing in different extra musical elements, whether it's biblical or sociopolitical or some other aspect. I think that'd be really great to hone in on.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because I struggled a lot, Cindy, in grad school and in my early, I'm still an early career scholar, but I struggled a lot to figure out how am I going to make my work fit within the discourse of musicology, which is known historically to be a very sort of, in many ways, hegemonically Eurocentric discipline.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And I use the word hegemonically strategically, right? Until like the 90s when you have this sort of new school musicology coming along with like folks like Lawrence Kramer, you know, Susan McCleary, they're looking at the sort of, you know, gendered racial implications of music, not just reducing it to the actual musical notes, not just doing musical analysis, right? And so I struggled profoundly with how, who am I going to engage? How am I going to sell this work as a musicological work, as a musicological book? Because all the people who were like writing about stuff similar to what I was writing about at the time were in the fields of religion, right? And were in the fields of, so those are the people I was engaging because I didn't know how to make it musicological, right? So thankfully I have there more resources, I guess, at my disposal now. But I think the ways in which my work is helping to broaden musicological discourse is I am looking at, for example, the influence of neo-Pentecostalism on the church, right? Like, for example, one of my chapters is on gospel love albums, which some of you all may be familiar with, right? And how gospel artists are beginning to engage the erotic and sexuality in ways that they hadn't done before, right? And so I talk about how the trends in the 1990s, the emergence of neo-Pentecostalism, which scholars have argued is basically an attempt to broaden the sort of cultural appeal of Pentecostalism, right? So it maintains the sort of conservative theologies of Pentecostalism, while also saying, but now we want to use all of this as a way to engage culture. And one of the moves of neo-Pentecostalism was to be a lot more open about sex and sexuality and eroticism. So I engage what's taking place in the church and what's taking place theology to make sense of the moves that these artists are making musically. Because gospel music, which I often say when I'm giving talks and when I'm writing, it's like necessarily interdisciplinary, right? You cannot, I don't think you can just, for the most part, just engage gospel music musically without considering how the theology and the spiritual experience is informing everything that's going on, right? So in order to, from my methodological perspective, in order to do gospel music justice, you have to consider the theologies, you have to consider the religion, you have to consider the experiential implications and how all of this comes together in music and performance.
Yeah, I find that that's really key. You want to understand the background circumstances that influence the music or the art that's being made. In my experience coming to Yale particularly, I wanted that particular theological dimensions filled out in the music that I study. And what you're doing is a really important, I think, understanding what music means in the broader context.
Exactly. And I would say I was really encouraged because I was just in Louisville, Kentucky, at another gathering with other scholars, and a person, she's a professor of religion, I believe, at Emory, and she was sort of basically saying that my work has great interdisciplinary appeal, and she said this is it's not just musicological, like we need this in the field of religion as well, right? So I am hoping that my work does sort of speak across disciplines and makes an impact beyond just musicological, ethnomusicological discourse.
If I'm being honest, this is quite inspiring for me as well. You know, even though I'm a master's student at Yale at the moment, I have been grappling with questions about doing a PhD, but at the same time, as we have mentioned earlier, doing a PhD in musicology has also sort of been something I've been hesitant to do because would that mean as a result that I would be engaging in, you know, scholarship and methodologies that just analyze scores? Like, I'm not even sure that that would be engaging for me in the long term, too. So having you as a model and seeing you try out new things and making musicology fresh in a way that I couldn't see or I hadn't seen as a conservatory student is really exciting and it's very appealing for me. So thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that. I love how you say my work makes musicology fresh. That is how I would like to see myself. And I, you know, and if you want to do musicology, I would encourage you to go in that direction, because I think now I can sense strongly that the tide, it's always a slow turn, but it is slowly and gradually turning. It's slowly, and they are more and more sort of opening up their conceptual, analytical, theoretical parameters to consider methodological, analytical approaches beyond what we have seen traditionally. So musicology, you know, and this is the era of DEI, right? So everybody is thinking about, okay, how can we broaden this to make it more inclusive? And how has our focus on a particular methodological approach been sort of implicitly and not so implicitly racist, exclusionary, right? We've just put it in this sort of language to make it seem like, oh, it's just methodological. But in what ways are our methodologies really excluding like an entire body of literature, an entire genres of music in ways that we are not aware?
Yeah, I think that's the critical point. It looks like it's packaged in some kind of sterile, innocuous sort of curriculum, right? Traditional musicology, that is. But actually, it in some cases, perhaps unwittingly, in other cases...
not so unwittingly. Sometimes unwittingly, perhaps not so, but I get it, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And so it's really important, I think you're absolutely right, it's really important to keep this in mind as we study what we want to study, especially in music, in all these various contexts, right? It's really important to have that in mind, because that's how we show ourselves as being responsible scholars and how we show ourselves to be responsible thinkers to the best that we can, right? There are limits, of course, but the idea is that we try to be better or improve upon ourselves and have that reflected in our scholarship and our work that we do at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
As I read your bio, I was particularly struck by the description of musical practice acting as a particular conduit to acknowledge and attempt to reconcile questions around race and identity. So we talked about it a little earlier. In other words, music is considered a crucial means to help address these complex issues, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate further on your research, not just its relevance to scholarship, but also to the wider, perhaps socio-political landscape. There's a sense in which musical practice, as you study it, is adjacent or perhaps directly converges with not just religion, but ethics at large. And that sounds really fascinating to me. It goes beyond theological and religious constructs, but you had mentioned DEI earlier. The sense that I'm feeling is that there's a question about ethics at large, and I was wondering if you could perhaps talk a little bit more about that too, and seeing how it goes outside of the religious spaces that it might be traditionally part of.
Yeah, yeah. So, first of all, I'm thrilled that my work has that kind of appeal, even like beyond religious spaces. Like I think one of my methodological approaches is to do feedback interviews. And so I literally have had these sort of like listening sessions where I have church people, you know, ministers and lay people, musicians, and they just listen to it and respond. And they love it because it provides for them a kind of space to be able to talk about these issues and how these issues even, you know, transcend the church. So I think one thing that makes my work unique is that it's also like intersectional, in that I talk about how constructions of realness through musical performance and discourse come to bear on various markers of identity, like race, class, sexuality, and gender. And so, for example, this chapter that I'm working on now, this chapter on worship, one of the questions that I ask is, so I coin like different modes of worship. Like I talk about cacophonous worship, unbridled worship, improvisational worship, ineffable worship. And in my unbridled worship section, I just kind of ask the question, because I define unbridled worship as this moment where people are coming together. There's no music. The music just leaves. The musicians stop playing, and it's sort of like just unbridled, unfiltered worship. And all you hear is like people speaking in tongues and hand clapping, and like the show just stops, right? Because the glory of God has taken over. And so the question I ask is, what does it mean, right, for Black people in this moment to worship in an unbridled manner, right? What are the larger ethical questions, right, for Black people, for us understanding what it means, even historically, right? When you think about Black people in the invisible institution having to carve out a place for themselves to be able to just praise God without any confinements or any, you know, consequences. What does it mean even in today's particular culture for Black people to worship God in a free manner without sort of being confined by any sort of white supremacist Eurocentric understanding of how we should comport ourselves? And then on top of that, right, I talk about the classed implications of worship, right? Because within the tradition of the Black church, even within gospel music, there has been sort of what I call an intra-racial conflict in terms of how should Black people carry themselves in order to be properly respected by white society, right? So if we act a fool in church and we're hollering and screaming, that's not a good look because that falls short of these standards of Black respectability, right? Versus people who are like, well, we don't have to like assimilate with the sort of Eurocentric standard of behavior, with the Eurocentric ethic. We can just be who we are and praise God, you know, how we know to praise God, right? So this question of ethics, of how to behave, of how things are received by the white majority, how we should be acceptably Black in the world, right, definitely ties into these different iterations and expressions of worship that I talk about in this chapter.
Yeah, I really like that. It speaks to a broader applicability. As a final question, I'd like to have you elaborate about your musical training and background. In particular, how do you see musical practice as informing your current research as a scholar, or perhaps do you see them in each other, or was that something that was more prevalent when you were a YDS student? I would like to see if you could elaborate on those particular experiences and if that's helped you in some ways or perhaps hindered you in others.
That's a good question. I mean, I think us performers who go into academia, we ask ourselves these questions all the time. I would say both and, right? I have felt like sometimes it has hindered me, and I've also felt like my research has actually like facilitated performance and been connected to it in very significant ways. So hindered it, meaning just in terms of time, right? It's like, I don't have time to perform. I don't have like, 'cause this book, this dissertation is taking over my life. Now getting a job is taking over my life. Now keeping my job is taking over my life. Now passing my third year review, and now getting this book done and getting these articles, right? It's just, I mean, academia is, as I often say, like an all-consuming fire that can just take up so much time until you feel like you don't have any time to pursue anything else. But what's promising for me is, like, we just had this chapel service at the beginning of February where they kind of made my work, the theme of my work, kind of the center of the chapel service. And so for each chapter, my Love Album chapter, my Worship chapter, my Songs of Redemption chapter, like, I would kind of give a summary of the larger religious theological implications of each of these chapters. And then, like, they would follow it up with a particular song or worship song that kind of showed how my work has that sort of musical theological relevance beyond academia. So that was pretty cool for them to like center it around my work to also show how this has relevance in performance and in the church at large. So things like that give me hope that my work has the kind of appeal and palatability beyond academia.
Yeah, certainly it must be rewarding for you as a scholar to see your work embodied in that broader context. But I also imagine that it's a gift to the community, too. And for the people and artists that you write about in your work, I would imagine that it is also equally just as rewarding for them to see that embodied in a serious manner, right? Engaged in scholarship at a very high intellectual level,
right,
that validates them in a situation where otherwise they may have not been acknowledged or validated in some other way.
Exactly. And I think that's some of the feedback that I got. It's like, wow, you know, Corey, you're really doing something great. And I see how my aspirations are attainable and achievable through seeing you. And it's like, wow, it does make you appreciate some of your scars and some of the traumas and, you know, some of the rejections that you've experienced along the way. Because it's like, okay, it was worth it. Even if it was, you know, when you are a kind of trailblazer or, you know, one of the, I guess, pioneers in your field, like I feel like my whole generation, we are pioneering Black music research in a different kind of manner, you know, standing on the shoulders of those who've come before us, but it's a different kind of iteration in how we're engaging scholarship. And in many ways, there was no model for us in terms of how to do it within this sort of contemporary academic market. And so, you know, I took the hits and took the bruises and the scars and, you know, went through a lot, but it makes it worth it. And it makes me grateful for my journey when I hear others coming behind me who say, your work is helping me to see another kind of possibility and for my work and to believe in my own work. That's extremely encouraging.
Yeah, that is really wonderful to hear. Well, I think that's all the questions I have for you today. Thank you, Corey, for being here with me and for talking about your work with me. This has been a really terrific discussion.
Thank you. Great conversation. Thank you so much.
For more information on the ISM Fellows Program, please visit ism.yale.edu/fellowships. Please join us again for more episodes of ISM Fellows in Conversation.